You're tuned to 103.5 WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro's 100-watt wonder. Listener-supported community radio.
You're listening to your community radio station, 103.5 FM, WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.
Hi there, this is Paul, and you're at WCOM in Carrboro, Chapel Hill, and this is Touchstones. Today we're going to take a slightly different turn. You know, this show has been is probably a true believer's paradise. Unfortunately, you have to believe many contradictory things in order to this. And what we're going to take on another thing is we're going to have a theme that I'm going to be discussing with my guest today, who's Catherine
Devine.
Catherine Devine. And she, like me, grew up being raised Roman Catholic. And so we are going to discuss the strangeness of being raised Catholic.
The challenge.
The challenge of being raised Catholic. And so, on that note, let's begin with, you know, many of us are raised without any religion at all. And when confronted with religion at various times in their lives, usually probably on the playground, if not in the school, but you learn on the playground, your other friends will talk about either being saved by Jesus or if they're from the South here. And you'll find that children are evangelizing each other's gently or not so gently, tribalizing each other, as it were, on the playground about religious identification. If it isn't race, if it isn't physical disabilities, if it isn't gender, then we are going to be dividing ourselves or learning how to categorize ourselves into various religious things. And, of course, many of us are not raised with religion, and we find this rather strange. The other thing is that parents have a strange sense of duty to their children, where they think somehow that you need to be religious in order to be moral.
Yes.
And many times
the the bad kid in the family was the one who was the least religious.
Yeah. And but the strange thing here is that a moral sense does not necessarily follow from a religious sense. And religion, believe it or not, does not have a rational corner on
a
the
rational
market.
Bone in its body.
Well, it doesn't have. Also, doesn't have a rational. It doesn't have a rational corner on the market of morality. In fact, in many cases, religious identity may actually mitigate against the development of an ethical sense because of other things, which we'll probably talk about. So, some of us have been burdened as children to have been brought into a religion, baptized probably before we could do anything but yow about it, and being that many of us, since Catholics practice infant baptism,
had to be within 2 weeks.
Yeah, and the good old days.
Rule.
Those are the good old days. Now the other thing is that both Kat and myself were raised in pre-Vatican II Catholicism. And I washed my hands of Catholicism before, or actually during Vatican II. And though I've kept myself abreast of the changes in the Catholic Church as a interested outsider, I can't identify myself as a Catholic. And when I was in seminary studying to be a minister, which was an ecumenical seminary, and there were many Catholic seminaries in it, as part of that ecumene, I refused to identify myself as an ex-Catholic because they treat you differently if they think you were once one of them.
Yes, I never said ex-Catholic ever.
Yeah,
it smells like divorce.
So tell me, what were your earliest religious memories or experiences, Kat?
Mostly fear. A lot of fear and a lot of, and so much discipline.
But what was the sensate, the sensate context for this fear and discipline?
Punishment.
age.
Okay, we're talking 6-7 years old. That was my first consciousness of being Catholic.
Now, do you remember going to church? Do we drag
to
church?
Oh, yes. We went to Mass every Sunday.
And remember, and at this time, children were in Mass. They didn't get shuntled off to religious education the way Protestants tend to do.
They called it Protestants call it Sunday school, I think.
Yeah.
We went to Mass, and we sat through the whole Mass.
This is true.
And it was Latin when I'm 56 years old. It was Latin Mass until, man, high school?
Well, for you, maybe. I left before the Latin Mass was de-Latinized, but I'm a little older. So what for me, my original context is being, a squirmy kid,
you know,
3-4 years old, you know, being bored in the stuffy pews. And, you know, the pews
there were 6 easy days a week and 1 hard one.
Uh-huh.
And that was Sunday.
And okay, so what was it like you sitting in those pews as a kid, as you can recall?
I'm going to tell you honestly. I sound like John Edwards already. Really, honestly, candidly.
Right.
I liked it. I liked Mass. Mm-hmm. I liked the rhythm of it. I liked the language of it.
The standing and the kneeling.
I loved the liturgy. I did.
Yeah. And what you could see of it, huh? The pomp and the circumstance.
Mm-hmm. And it was choreographed.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't compare it to dancing,
mm-hmm.
but it was choreographed.
Yeah.
And all the trappings of Mass, the vestments.
Right, and the incense on the high holy days when they did it.
And the bells that sounded so pretty.
Right, that meant that you had to...
It meant you had to throw yourself on the floor.
Right. Yeah, and then I guess around 6 years old, 6-7 is when they push on First Communion, so...
I've got the picture to prove it.
Oh, you've got the picture to prove it. No, we're not going to post this on the internet, folks. But I will look at it.
You could. I wouldn't mind.
I got it. You're the one with the bridal veil on.
That's right.
And so becoming
a
bride.
They dressed us like brides.
A bride of Christ.
With a veil.
And I assume that you were from a Irish Catholic?
Half Irish, half Italian.
Oh, you got a double whammy of two styles.
Did.
You got the northern style and the southern style of Catholicism. And one boy, that must have been trippy. And so there you were. And was this picture taken before or after your actual communion?
That was before we left for church.
Yeah, so it was
before I got messed up.
Before you had the opportunity to experience the host.
Yes.
Were you allowed?
I've never tasted it before.
Were you allowed to chew?
We're not supposed to.
You didn't warn. See, now this is not true anymore, folks. I mean, now you take it in your hands, but in the good old days,
never touched
you're not allowed to touch it except with your tongue.
And we let it melt on our tongue.
Yeah.
And it was ostensibly, can I get going here?
Yes.
It was ostensibly the body of Christ.
Yeah.
And that's something we were supposed to believe.
Yes. This is serious, folks. Yes, it's bread, but it is actually Jesus Christ.
It's the body of Christ.
Yes.
And I don't think any other religion, Episcopalians have similar Mass communion
liturgy,
but they're not told that it's the actual body. It's just a symbol.
Mm-hmm. Modernism, creeping modernism. Mm-hmm. See, what's wonderful about the Catholicism is that, which I think is actually one of the strengths of this religion, even though I do agree that it messes up, and we'll talk about for me, it was an overriding sense. When you were talking about fear, for me, it was an overriding sense of guilt, being guilty about being alive, essentially.
Okay.
And that's how I felt at a later time. And also being introduced at this relatively early age of 6 and 7 years old to at that time, the confessional. And this, by the way, these teachings have changed. They have changed since Vatican II. They don't emphasize confession in the way that they did then, which was basically a laundry list of sins, and you were there to learn the laundry list and then recite it.
I recited the same sins every Saturday.
Yeah, and so...
And I changed the numbers. Only the numbers have changed.
Only the numbers. I mean, how many times did you do something? You didn't want to
overemphasize it. I did all the same stuff, but sometimes I did it a lot, and sometimes I did it a little.
Yeah, well, there are probably some sins you stayed away from,
and
though.
And so here's the guilt thing. I was lying.
Yeah.
I'd pop some lies in there at the end, and I lied 8 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about how many times you were sinning, yeah. But the... Be it many or fewer, it's hard to say. I got kicked out of confessional once, but that's some years later. That's many years later.
Okay.
In due course. Before you learn that wonderful thing, let's discuss some. Continue to reflect back on
let's
this
go
early
back to
earliest
first grade.
Experiences. Yeah, earliest experiences of being cathected. So, did you go to a Catholic school then?
Of course.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yes, I did.
Yes. Okay. Well, so tell me about that.
The Catholic school back in my day really was taught by nuns. You know, there's not the dearth of nuns that we have in the Catholic church mm-hmm. these days. They were all nuns.
Yeah.
They were not all old. Some of them were happy. Some of them mm-hmm. were not.
Right.
They just all wore that wild get-up.
That's strange. Your strange habit, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the black stuff on the cardboard.
It was distracting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wimple. And my sister was a nun for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And she's a younger sister.
My older sister.
She's an older sister.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she went into the Dominican convent and stayed for 5 years. And our father was in heaven.
He thought he had done right by his daughters.
Oh, gosh.
Huh?
It was marvelous. You know, our brother, other families had sons who became priests.
Mm-hmm.
And they were as proud and thrilled that their children had turned into nuns and priests.
I remember it was, it's in these early grades. I was in Catholic school, too, up until the third grade. And I remember a first or second grade, you know, the priest comes in, you know, and a rare visit.
Father,
do you
Cassilis.
Want to become a priest? How many here want to become priests or nuns? And, you know, the whole class stands up except me, right? You know, that's because I wasn't paying any attention to what was going on. But, you know, and I was looking at everybody else. Like, what? Where are they going there?
That's it. On a certain level, they were training us.
Mm-hmm.
To want that.
Yeah, to aspire.
To aspire.
Yeah, to aspire. Yeah, exactly. Of course. You know, I mean, and that, and it was sort of, you know, if you have a large family, you know, you give one. You know, in fact, you know, when they were discussing abortion, you know, the possibility of abortion back in the days, you know, whether they should allow abortion, an old woman got up and talked to the Pope, and she says, if you allowed abortion, there will be no priests and no nuns, because the family will want the family to survive first, and it's only those unwanted second and third kids that ever get shunted off to the church.
Oh.
And, you know, and they thought about this, and I don't know if this was the reason. I doubt if it was, and it's kind of draconian to think that it would be. That this was the reason why they were you know concerned with allowing family planning to become part of the Catholic hegemony, the official Catholic position. Now, of course, all American Catholics practice various forms of birth control, and do not have the large families that you or I may have come from. How many were in your family?
4 kids.
Yeah, that was 4 in my family, too, which
mm-hmm.
was...
That's pretty normal.
That was pretty normal. We're talking 50s folks. You know,
this is
normal for a Catholic family in those days. And as I remember some Catholic families being even fewer than that from my day. But the... you know, Catholics have been practicing... American Catholics have been practicing birth control of various sorts. Whether the church allows it or not, you know, this is just this is just preemptive over the culture.
Remember the rhythm method?
Well, being a male, I only knew of it theoretically. I always knew that if you actually had intercourse with a woman during her period, you didn't have to worry about pregnancy.
Probably not.
And probably not. Yeah, I mean, it'd be pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
But that was considered the messy method. So from a male point of view, it was problematic. Rubbers, prophylactics were common, particularly for the more casual sexual contact people. That's, again, we're talking in the 70s and 80s, folks, you know.
Oh, well, by the 70s, I had blown the entire thing off.
Blown what off?
Catholicism. The faith, and even my personal definition of sin changed also.
Okay.
I'm still Catholic. I put Catholic on the religion line on forms.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have a conscience, and I know what was a sin and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And they did teach us pretty indelibly that we were better than other people.
Ooh. Sort of like we inherited the mantle of the chosen people, folk.
Uh-huh.
I know the Jewish people think they're chosen, and they were up until Jesus came, and then we were. I don't know. This is a non-ordinary understanding of chosen. You know, this is chosen as select or elect, which is not the real meaning of the chosen people Jews
or for
Christians.
A real vain sense of having been chosen.
And that's the wrong interpretation.
That's wrong, darn it.
It's the wrong interpretation of what this chosen means. Actually, it means supposed to be try to be better than other people, not because you are, but because you're required to be. It's, in other words, it becomes not a privilege but a duty, and like in most duties, it's messy. So let's talk about your. We have the strangeness of confession, which, you know, one of the sacraments of the church that was taught at a very, very early age. I was profoundly confounded by the needing to confess sins
and be absolved of them.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, and again, I kind of went in there, and I didn't quite know what the heck. Well, the other thing is that I was slow when I was young. I was backward. I mean, they eventually kicked me out of Catholic school because they said I was going to be. I was. You know, something was wrong with me, and I was retarded.
Ouch.
Or something. I wasn't retarded. I was actually extremely smart in that nobody noticed, and nobody was paying any attention, and I needed special attention to get my smartness out. But what happened is that my slightly autistic personality just didn't quite fit into, the way people were regimented in the day. And the, but... You know, and the reason I actually know this is that I was, you know, I remember the in a very incomplete sense the catechesis training that one had in the first, second, and third grades, which is, you know, age appropriate. And then I dropped out of Catholicism and paid no attention to it at all as I went to public schools and rarely ever went to church. Actually, I started going to church as a beginning adolescent. I was about 12 or 13.
Your parents didn't make you go to church?
No. And I only went then so that I didn't have to be at home and I could wander around in the streets. I didn't actually go to church. I just wandered around on the streets and walked around.
Well, yeah. I stopped going to Mass when I got my driver's license.
When you were 16, huh?
Because I would drive myself to the 9 o'clock Mass or to the noon Mass.
Yeah.
Where my parents were going to the 11. And I would just drive around and drink coffee. Yeah. I go to the coffee shop and have some coffee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I took my little sister with me.
With the two of us, I drove.
Uh-huh.
The in my particular case, I was a bit younger, and instead of driving myself, we walked. You know, we walked up to the church. But the I walked around. I walked around the neighborhood. You know, occasionally hung out with friends, but for the most part, I just walked around. You know, I used to walk up and used to read comics at the local drugstore.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, anything just to walk around.
Uh-huh.
You know, and, you know, yeah. So it was, I was getting exercise. The but that was later. And the part that, you know, the formative part for me is in this early period, the, you know, the 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old child who is absorbing the Catholicism. The reason why is that about the eighth grade, you know, so it was about 4 years later, a friend of mine dragged me into the Catholic's catechism, you know, for kids who were in public school. And I sat in on the eighth grade class, which was a year or so above me, and I'd been away, and the nun there was asking them, they were getting ready for their confirmation, and asked a couple of questions. And nobody knew the answer except me.
The confirmation questions were hard. Pardon me. They were long, long memorized answers.
Oh, I just knew them.
You did?
Yeah. She was really surprised. No, I never got confirmed. I refused. I did a 10 catechism at this, in this pre-adolescent. Pre-puberty period, which is when I was beginning to have my intellectual awakening, which, you know, the dawn of that was very much around the issues of religious questions because I was doing catechism. But I had questions, and the questions remained questions. And the questions didn't become or didn't get converted into faith. You know, I just stuck with them in a sort of bullheaded, you know, only the way a prepubescent bullheaded kid can do it. You know, and eventually they, you know, they drummed me out of Catholicism. But the nun that ran the program said, "Paul," she says, "you actually have much more faith than any most of the kids that have ever come through here." She says, "you just have to do it your own way." She says, "so you should probably read the Bible yourself."
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I knew.
Relaxing. That's very relaxing.
Well, I knew I was on a religious path, and you know, she said that I should be, you know, go to the Jesuits and talk to them. So, you know, but I never did. At least not then. So we're talking about. I sort of want to keep it here at childhood, and when I was starting to fall into adolescence. I think they're two very different phases of religious doubt. Most every adolescent, to varying degrees, goes through a period of storm and strong and question. Not only about the authority of religious questions, that's us who have had the weirdness of being raised in a religion, but even secular kids who don't have that religious issues are going to be raising these things before themselves. So,
well, there are several phases, I think,
yeah,
of this,
yeah,
faith-based path. Mm-hmm. The first phase for me, and I've done a lot of pondering about this since you invited me to come in today.
Yeah.
The first phase, you just didn't understand it.
Right.
The vocabulary
mm-hmm.
was foreign, and we were memorizing words like transubstantiation.
Yeah.
And Immaculate Conception,
yeah.
And we did not know what that meant, and nobody told us.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, then we got a little older, and we found out what it meant, and I didn't believe it.
Okay, so what is the Immaculate Conception?
This is the notion that Jesus' mother conceived him without sex.
No, that's not true.
Uh-oh.
That's not the Immaculate Conception. That is the wrong-headed notion of the Immaculate Conception that Protestants have. The true meaning of the Immaculate Conception is that Mary was born without sin.
Oh, that too, yeah.
Yeah, no, she was born without sin.
She was, and that's the immaculate part?
Yeah. Not sex, but sin. She was born without sin, so that she could be...
But all this jazz about being a virgin. The Blessed Virgin.
Yeah, well, that's the reason why, even though she had children...
There is debate
in the church that whether she had one child or more than one child, is that her perpetual virginity doesn't have to do with the state of her hymen. It actually has to do with the state of her soul.
Okay, it's pure.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's pure in this sense. I mean, you know, I could be wrong, and I could be wrong about this, but I've looked into it, and the... think about that, when you think about virginity as the purity of one's soul, even though, you know, all of us, the rest of us folks supposedly were born with the burden of
original
sin, which was something our ancestor did to us.
A little blotch.
Yes, our little even Adam in our genes. The miraculousness is that, in that way, you could see that. If you understand virginity as this kind of purity of soul, or innocence of soul, or just, you know, naivete, you know, then there are many women who may be incredibly sexually experienced who are still incredibly virginal in the sense of being pure, purity themselves,
nice.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I wish people would look at virginity rather than this strange patriarchal view of, you know, who owns entry to the sanctum.
the notion that Daddy had.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing that here we have somebody who was raised Catholic for a while and still. Was, you know, and I remember hearing that in the schoolyard, you know, the thing about Mary never had sex, you know,
at
Joseph never had sex.
We didn't talk about that stuff
well,
at
I'm
all.
Well, I'm a boy.
Ooh.
Yeah, boys, we got exterior plumbing, so we're more likely to exteriorize our sexual proclivities.
This is great. This is 2 days in a row. Yesterday with a male friend of mine, and now today with you, I'm getting a male perspective.
Uh-huh.
Who says, well, as a, and I was jabbering about something, and he said, mm-hmm. Well, from a male perspective, I think this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 180 degrees.
Yeah, yeah.
And very generous of him to say, well, think of it this way.
It's another way of saying, well, yeah, I mean, you know, of course, you know, the thing was is that, you know, even though, I mean, boys are curious about sex without even knowing what a sex drive is at this early prepubescent sense of the view.
And you find out without warning.
What sex is?
What a sex drive is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It hits you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, well, I was pretty much out of Catholicism by the time my sex drive came to fruition, as it were. But I did suffer from something which developed in this early period of confession, which was an overriding sense of guilt. In fact, I felt guilty about natural urges.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so in other words, instead of learning that, you know, if I felt envy or anger or I stole something because of having feelings or of not being recognized or whatever the things are, just covetousness, whatever they were.
Yeah.
Rather than learning from these things and learning to accept them and moderate them within myself, I had this kind of thing where I should mention them and then try to pretend that I could throw them away. And this gave me a sense of, because what it was is it was telling me not to know myself. And so here's a perversion, and I think this is maybe one of the reasons why they've changed the confessional mode. This is the way they teach it to children now. Because confession is supposed to be the way one develops and exercises Christian conscience. And yet what we were learning to turn it into was a form of punitive, super egoic, beat ourselves up, feel bad about being a person, right? In other words, so that one's natural desires, whether they be sexual or otherwise, and one's natural sense of justice and injustice and belonging and not belonging and all the things that go on in the world that are right or wrong and that one has feelings about, were somehow being profoundly shunted aside into some kind of weird sin sieve.
Boy, I was really a dumb little kid. I'm a very, very, very smart person.
Mm-hmm.
And
we are dumb. We're all dumb kids. But, I mean, that just, you know, goes with the development.
But, you know, we were raised with to feel chronically guilty, just chronically.
Yes.
And in the confession line on Saturday afternoons,
mm-hmm.
there were not only children in that line, but there were adults.
Yeah.
And I, the little 7-year-old kid, would say, well, what do the adults do in there? What do they have to, they didn't talk back to their parents, and they didn't lie, and they didn't hit their little sister. You know,
did your little sister?
Oh, yeah.
Now, the question is, did your parents hit you? Did your father hit you with any regularity?
Sometimes, yes.
Was it ritualized, or was it a lash out?
It was spontaneous.
Yeah, that's scary.
Mom did that, too.
She did the lash out, too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for the most part, to the degree that corporal punishment was in my family, well, some of it was based on, you know, just utterly frustrating. And I was probably a really frustrating kid. Because a kid who was ignored as well as I was knew how to be really obnoxious to get in my way. And I'm sure I drove my mother and, to a lesser extent, my father to incredible degrees of distraction with my whiny behavior. But the and so that there was an occasional lash out, but it was a lash out within that context of my being obstinate pretty bullheaded myself. For the most part, it was ritualized. You know, it was slightly ritualized in the sense that you did something wrong and you're going to be punished. And
no,
there was a space like that.
They never said, come in here and I'm going to hit you. No, it was just bam.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's one thing my mother did. She was never really religious. She always went to Mass. And
mm-hmm.
and she was a good enough person.
Right.
When we were complaining about something, Mom would say, offer it up. Just offer it up.
And this meant?
And that was the only prayerful note that ever came out of her mouth.
Which was like, give it.
You could get some kind of, what's the word?
Merit.
It's not merit. It's something, I forget the word.
Mm-hmm.
That accumulates.
Yeah. Sanctification.
The obvious, the opposite of demerits. You got these good things.
Yeah, right. Well, they strengthened you for if you learned how to suffer right, then you would you would make a good soldier for Christ because you could suffer with dignity and suffer with the humility and the dignity of a Jesus. The imitation of Jesus was also a very strange part because there was such emphasis on his sanctification that he was God clunking around, and then the inscrutableness of his words in the Gospels. Right? I remember listening to the Gospels over and over again and finding them tremendously profound things, but it did give me this incredible sense of guilt. And as I said about the confessional, we were in this situation to where the confessional as practiced then, and let's emphasize, folks, this is pre-Vatican II Catholicism. We are not saying this is the way it was for people before then. And led to the sense of guilt of not being comfortable with myself. How did that guilt work for you?
It kept me sad most of the time. It was hard to be happy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just purely it was.
Yeah. Well,
happiness was.
Yeah, a natural joy was something that you were suspicious of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
another thing, the Catholic Mass always featured a sermon
mm-hmm.
by the priest, which was invariably a condescending lecture about how bad we all were.
Well, yeah, I don't remember that much, but that's okay. Let's keep going.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's keep going.
Yeah.
You want to hear my essay about the Ten Commandments?
Sure. Okay, now when did you write this?
I wrote this, Paul, 6 or 7 years ago.
Okay.
And it was in connection with a regional debate about instituting uniforms in the public schools.
Okay.
Which I thought was a great idea. I still
at the time. Yeah, well, it's a way to move the sort of...
I went to some of their meetings.
Yeah.
And, you know, to...
Lessen the defend. Gang, the gang thing and the other kinds of status mm-hmm. things the kids are doing with
and
clothes.
And just, uniforms make life so easy.
You have this, this thing you wear that...
Made life very easy.
Yeah.
Even then, I was conscious of that.
Okay, so, read it, Kat.
This is called What a Concept. Just when you thought you heard everything, there's talk of uniforms and the Ten Commandments in school. What a concept. We wore blue wool caps to daily mass at Our Lady of Sorrows. The Sisters of Mercy wore a get-up of black and white armor, distracting enough to make you forget how to read. First grade was taught by Sister Mary Johanna. She wasn't a witch, but her habit made me think of Witch Hazel from the comic books, and she scared me much more than Witch Hazel did. Sister Johanna was jealous of my red felt skirt. She always hit me when I had it on. Sister Johanna had only one commandment: Thou shalt not infuriate me by committing a single imperfect act. We were 6-year-olds. The rules of that classroom had us totally confounded. There was another set of rules that calmed us because they never changed. Our class of little Catholics recited the Ten Commandments hypnotically. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not have false gods before me. It was the only time you ever saw God spelled with a small g, which felt a lot like looking at a sin. Sister Mary Johanna told us that false gods were garish, ugly statues of monsters with lots of heads and arms. We didn't dare worship them. Taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain was inconceivable. Remember to keep holy the Lord's Day. This rule meant going to Mass before breakfast, all dressed up, singing Glory in Excelsis Deo, saying the Apostles' Creed, fidgeting through a long lecture, snacking on the actual body and blood of Christ, and going home to the 3 best meals of the week. Dad's fried eggs with salami, his perfectly charred steak with garlic salt, a long secret late afternoon, and then, during Lassie, bologna sandwiches with chocolate milk. Ed Sullivan, Bonanza, believe me, the Lord's Day was holy. Honor thy father and thy mother, or else, kapow, a no-brainer. Killing was for grown-ups. Adultery was never explained. Thy neighbor's wife was somehow caught up in that. Lying comes naturally to a little kid, whereas bearing false witness against thy neighbor does not. The commandment should have been, thou shalt not say you didn't do it if you really did. Which brings us to coveting the goods in thy neighbor's desk, looking both ways before we actually took stuff. Thou shalt not steal. You could get in big trouble for stealing then, just as you can today. Some things never change. Sister Johanna never changed her clothes. Witch Hazel never changed her clothes. I knew what would happen on days when I wore the red skirt. Sameness did a good job back then. At Our Lady of Sorrows, our little blue caps kept us on some level in the same boat, not only with each other, but with Sister Johanna and Witch Hazel, too. Sameness made it easy to see who was in charge, to show respect and fear, and not to lie or steal or curse, and to know when you were being bad. What a concept.
Yes, this reminds me of the reason that the Wiccans in the olden days used to go skyclad, and this way, which means they were naked in their ceremonies, and the reason why this way, they wouldn't use their clothing as a way of distinguishing their class.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and actually this is true even to the day to some degree, though America has become incredibly less formal. You know, people don't wear suits, business suits, as much as they used to. Men don't wear ties as much as they used to, except in certain formal corporate settings. You you are, as it were, not showing your class. People wear, you know, T-shirts, and they wear casual wear. But you will see that there are ways that people who have money wear clothing in a certain way. That is very different than the people who have less money. And the clothing you can buy at Walmart is not the clothing that you can buy at some of the more upper crust stores around. So even though we've become more informal as a society, you can still, if you're so observant and care about these things, and believe it or not, plenty of us are, we pay attention to our designer marks. And of course, we also know some of the stuff is completely artificial. And market, you know, advertising driven. I mean, this is
yes.
Such as the designer sneakers that people have been killed over, and in some examples. Still the point is that we have this orientation towards class and towards wanting to distinguish ourselves through superficial means, and uniforms is one of the ways to avoid that. But again, the upper-class kid is going to wear a uniform that's much more neatly tailored than the lower-class kid who's getting their hand-me-downs from their brother or sister who went to the school before them. But I think what was interesting about your piece was the sense of, you know, the Ten Commandments. As I brought in a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the most recent one, which from my point of view is the second edition based on the Latin thing. And, you know, there's a whole section of it. I think section 3 in there deals specifically with the Ten Commandments and following them. And they do it in an adult way where you do both the thou shalt not, which you shouldn't do, but also what you should do. You know, and that every you know, sin has a positive.
I think keep holy the Lord's Day is the only positive commandment.
Yeah.
The others are all don't.
Well, that's just in the way they're set up, but they're still set up in a way that there's a why is it that you don't take the Lord the name in vain? Because the way you're building your relationship with God is in a positive setting, so you use the name of the Lord as a way of respect and of address and humility and the various ways that you would supplement make sublimation to the to the divine, which is a feeling state. You know, so you're offered to, develop certain feelings around this name. You know, it's idolatrously.
Oh, boy, talk about names. My last name is Divine.
Yes, that was a big something to live up with. Something to live up with. Was that your married name, or
it's my born name.
That's your born name. So
I really like it.
Yeah. So I could see that. I would like if I had a name like Divine, I'd like it too. Of course, Nagy in Hungarian means magnificent, so I'm doing pretty good. You may be divine, but I'm magnificent.
You win.
Yes, yes. Yes.
And when we sang the Christmas carols, O Night Divine, we loved that one because it was our night.
belonged to you. Now, you had an Italian father who had the last name of Divine?
I was Italian, Mom.
An Italian mom.
Dad is Divine.
Okay, so
the patriarch.
And the Irish. And these good old Irish.
He was quite the tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
The tyrant.
And, well, you have to remember, too, that, that there are profound patriarchal values within Christianity in this traditional mode, you know, where the priest was only the only one who was allowed to perform the sacraments, and he had to be a male. And the nuns, to a degree, they were allowed to teach school, but they were never allowed to.
It was so unfair. Of course, our Catholic family, we were really popular in the parish. The priests all came over on Sundays and partied their heads off with my parents.
Oh, that's interesting.
They partied their heads off, and sometimes on Saturday nights until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's interesting.
And the priests were allowed to smoke and drink.
That's right. And the nuns, less so. They were a little more cloistered.
Yeah. None of that.
Yeah. Nuns were more cloistered in these days. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, many nuns now don't live at all within the cloisters.
They've got lives.
Yeah, they all live out, and of course...
And careers. And
the good point of that is that they're allowed to fully develop their professional identity, and the rough part of it is they might suffer from aspects of the devotion.
About, 8 years ago now. And I don't know for sure because I don't have a printed copy of this. I think I wrote for the newspaper, a newspaper column.
Right.
The column editor called me from the Chapel Hill News on Good Friday afternoon because her assigned columnist for Easter Sunday had gone AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
And could I write a column for Easter Sunday, please, now?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah.
Okay.
And it was literally the sacred time between noon and 3 on Good Friday.
And you were sitting down to write this thing.
I'm sitting down to write this thing. And, Paul, I'm surprised nobody threatened me after that. I put in this column how unbelievable the whole thing is. And I wrote, if you believe in the resurrection, then you should believe in the Easter Bunny. That's the one.
That's the one quote you remember, huh?
I thought, oh my God! Yeah. When I typed that, it was done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Easter bunnies lay eggs, folks. Little multicolored eggs that sometimes are candy and sometimes are yolks. Yeah.
Now, what do you know about the Assumption?
The physical Assumption.
Yes. We're supposed to believe that.
Yes, yes, yes. This is true. Well,
what the Assumption is.
Well, let's before we get into the Assumption, let's talk a little bit about Catholicism grew out of a time when people were agrarian, meaning they lived mostly on the land.
Yeah.
You know, there were country bumpkins and the cities were were supported an artisan class. You know, the basic way that the upper classes worked on patronage, which meant that as an upper class person you employed a number of folk to do various things. You were their patron, and people sought patronage, various artisans and so forth. We had an agrarian view of the world, which was poetic, and a poetic in the sense that metaphors were half believed in, in a way that we don't believe metaphors anymore. And yet, it's still the basis of the way we make meaning. It's the way our language changes, is through metaphors that become new metaphors become made. Which are, which are done basically through various forms of analogy. You know, it's like the leg of a chair is a kind of dead metaphor, but it's because the chair leg looked like a human leg and so forth, or a leg on a horse.
Oh, okay.
But so this metaphoric speech is poetic in the sense that it's semi-magical. And this sense of magic of speech and the magic of metaphor and its transformative thing, it's sort of the logic of identity of Aristotle, which is A equals A, is logic, but that's not metaphor. Because metaphor is A is like B. And B is unlike A. And C is a little like B, but a little less like C. So you see what you have in in metaphoric worlds is you have a world that isn't quite, everything isn't quite exactly what it's supposed to be. And this is the way our language works. And this poetic view of the world is something that our mechanical and technological worldview and scientific worldview that we take for granted has blunted for us. Though we are still, our language is based on metaphors. When we become emotional about something, our metaphors will become immediate, and our language will become concrete in a way, and not abstract, like this language here that I'm using now, but it'll become less abstract. We, have a sense of immediacy to it. And in some ways, you have to understand the dogmas of the church are sort of like big, dead metaphors for the mystery and magicalness of the world, which makes a lot more sense if you're a farmer participating in the mystery of life in order to survive than it does if you're a computer programmer, endlessly chopping around, figuring out ways to make
zeros and ones.
Zeros and ones into A equals A and A equals not A, and its variations. So, the reason I bring this up is you really have to, in some ways, the dogma of the church is the dream of the church. And in the dream language is, unlike Aristotelian logic language, is A equals the alphabet, and B equals a different alphabet, and C equals a different alphabet. And the assumption, which is that the physical body of Jesus and the physical body...
No, it's Mary.
No, yeah, there's another. Yeah, well, Jesus assumed into heaven, too.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, after his resurrection. And the physical body, the assumption with Mary, and actually in some ways, a physical assumption of Mary became dogma, which is back in the 19th century,
there was a picture of it in the catechism book.
It was a relatively recent dogma. But you know, one of the things that Carl Jung said about that, and given the rise of the goddess in our own culture, which I think is one of the most important religious innovations to have. In fact, one of our next speakers, I think maybe even next week, is going to specifically be addressing the issue of the goddess and the emergence of the goddess.
Goody.
Because the assumption of the Virgin Mary is the beginning at a very deep sort of dream level of the beginning to realize that there is... a deeper recognition of the divinity of the divine feminine. And of course, Mary has carried that burden. She is, after all, the mother of God. So she has carried, as it were, the burden of not only being the mother of God, but the mother of all gods, of all gods. Well, that's why the Immaculate Conception, which was an earlier dogma that came into the church, it was a continuation of bringing more and more, giving the aura of the sanctity of the divine feminine. The very fact that the Da Vinci Codes was so important for so many people, and so many people read it with such avowedness, and so many people wanted to believe it, this frank fiction, and not a very good mystery, but they wanted to believe it because people want to know, where is the divine feminine? Where is the image, the divine image that is genderized woman as man is genderized man?
It's on a grilled cheese sandwich.
You're going to find this image on the grilled cheese sandwich. Well, to be honest with you, I'd rather find it in a living human woman and
of course,
or man.
Wouldn't we all?
But rather than...
I'm sorry to be so cynical.
That's okay. But it's part of poetic speech, and in some ways, the way you have to understand the dogmas of the church is a form of poetry. Unfortunately, it's a poetry that people have definitely killed each other about in the past, historically, and have
there
killed other peoples
yeah.
about, which is kind of strange that people have killed each other over their understanding of their dreams, but it's not unusual. It's going to happen in the future. It's happening now with the strange perversions of Islam that are taking place in our society, both in its misrepresentation by the jihadists and the Islamicists, and the silence and the being cowed of the majority of Muslims who know that this is a complete and utter falsification of the way that what Islam is. That the submission of Islam is not the submission to tyranny, but is rather a submission to the divine. And the divine is not a tyrant, but the at least in the Islamic sense. But we've, so we are, as it were, victims of our poetry, of our dreams. And we need to learn how to interpret them. And in fact, learning how to interpret your dreams is probably the best way to reconcile with the insanity of the theologies that we were brought up with. I'll give you, let's see, where are we time-wise? Oh, we are completely out of time. But let me tell you one story, Kat.
Okay.
And then we can wrap up.
I'm
going to
tell you one thing, too. Go.
The one story, well, you know, I dropped out. I pretty much refused confirmation by the time I was 13 years old when confirmation time came around. I didn't want to have anything to do with things. Well, not my family wasn't involved. I mean, they could have insisted, but I would have been as obstinate with them as I would have been with anything. I was basically beyond the pale as far as the authority issue went at that point. But it wasn't that I didn't have a religious quest, that I've obviously been interested in religion my entire life in varying forms. But most of it really hasn't been Christian. I did attempt to reconcile with Christianity. I mean, even I went to a Christian seminary, and in a Christian seminary, I insistent that I was going to try to reconcile my issues with things. I was going to a Protestant interdenominational school. Some of my best classes were in the Catholic seminaries. I enjoyed them incredibly. The spiritual direction classes I took were fascinating. And the, biblical history classes I took were fascinating. And I got a good sense of what adult religion was like. But I never quite reconciled to the narrowness of the Christians that I knew and or what Christianity was. And I can't really quite call myself a Christian, mainly because of its univocality. Most Christians think that if you profess Christ, you abstain from or you renounce all other ways to the divine. Whereas my understanding of Christianity, which is one of the ways, one of the minority ways that Christianity understood, is if you profess Christ, you bring into Christ all the other ways of religion, that there is a universal meaning of Christianity, and we'll talk about that some other time. I did at one point during my adolescence have a little crisis of faith, which I won't get into too many of the details, though they're all very fun and bizarre, in which case I eventually found myself after years going back to church and just popping in to a Sunday service. And guess what the gospel was?
What?
The prodigal son.
Aww.
Wasn't that cute?
That's very poetic.
Yeah, it was poetic. And then I rushed off to a confessional. I finally decided to go see the Jesuit. And I tried to confess my sins, and he threw me out of the confessional because I wasn't sorry for my sins.
Oh, wow.
He said I was telling him that I had learned from my sins. And though I was sorry for them, obviously, I knew they weren't right.
Them.
I regretted them.
Yeah.
Yes, I regretted them.
Uh-huh.
I also recognized that they taught me something. This is not allowed. he said. This is not the way, this is not a teaching of the church.
That sins have value. Yeah.
Yeah. That, so, you know, some sins have value if you learn from them and not do them anymore. If you learn that something hurts and hurts you or hurts other people and you don't do it anymore, that's something good. Good to learn. But unfortunately, the way the confessional used to be for 6-year-old and 7-year-old children, that wasn't what they were teaching. Again, this is pre-Vatican II, folks.
In that scary little closet.
Okay, Kat, so you wanted to say something?
Just one note. Something sad happened earlier this week. William F. Buckley died.
Yeah.
A brilliant, brilliant
Yes, definitely
mind.
A brilliant guy.
He bought the whole thing. He was a very, very devout Catholic.
Well,
who believed it.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And I thought, but he's so smart. But he believed it.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, there's a lot to believe. In about 3 weeks, we're going to have someone on who's in charge of adult catechisms for much of the local archdiocese.
And, super, I'll tune into that.
And I'm sure he will have a less than skeptical view of what Catholicism is. So, folks, we gave you a little bit of the skeptic's approach to how we are deformed by our religions. And I'm sure that many of you also have stories of equal wonder and strangeness to share with us. If you do, feel free to give me a call, leave a message for me here at the station. You can email me at pnagy@wordtrade.com. That's wordtrade.com. And tell me what you'd like to share sometime on the show. You've been listening to Touchstones on WCOM, communityradio.coop. And we're coming from you in wonderful